Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. The Karen Wetterhahn Memorial Award recognizes one outstanding graduate student or postdoctoral researcher who exemplifies qualities of scientific excellence. And in December, that recognition arrived in Molly Fraser's inbox, singling out her research at UK to develop inexpensive and reusable materials that can selectively absorb PFAS compounds. These are the compounds that have been commonly used for decades to coat things to be stain-resistant, waterproof, or nonstick. They've been used in everything from carpets to nonstick cookware to firefighting foams. Convenient and effective in their intended uses, for sure, these chemicals also are associated with some serious health problems, and they persist in the environment for a very, very long time. Molly joins us to talk about her work to rid the environment of these compounds, and also a passion of hers, encouraging more women to consider careers in science. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Molly.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, first, let's talk about PFAS compounds. I mentioned that they've been widely used, but how pervasive are these chemicals in our environment, and how do they affect our health?
Well, they've been dubbed as forever chemicals for a reason, right? So there is currently no environmental half-life of these chemicals, which means they don't go away, they don't degrade. Basically, they just move around in our water and our soil and air and even throughout our own bodies and those of, you know, the animals around us. And a lot of research has been conducted recently, and that links, you know, pretty significant health consequences to exposure to these PFAS chemicals. And some of those include breast cancer, liver cancer, testicular cancer, and very sadly, significant developmental effects to children, both pre or post-birth. And something else that's interesting is that, there's a high correlation that PFAS exposure leads to reduced response to vaccines, which we know while in the midst of a pandemic can be extremely detrimental. And so I just, you know, we'll follow that up with that the CDC reports that 97% of Americans have PFAS in their blood.
Keeping in mind that most of us, if we're lucky, know just about enough about this kind of thing to be dangerous, and that's certainly true in my case, but I wonder if you would explain how the materials that you've developed work to remove these compounds from the environment.
If you think of a water filter, say, in your home, maybe, you know, you have a Brita or a Pure filter, those filters have a column of material that the water flows through and filters your water. So typically that column is, you know, charcoal or various mineral media. And these type of filters are not designed to specifically target PFAS. They target compounds such as chlorine and mercury and other heavy metals. So my materials are designed to specifically attract PFAS through interactions that can occur between the PFAS, which is negatively charged, and then my filter material, which is positively charged.
And what is the outcome? To what extent does it remove PFAS compounds?
So some of the materials that I have created show, you know, upward of 98% removal of some of the most commonly detected PFAS, such as PFOA and PFOS.
Have these been put to use? Are they out there in the market yet?
They're not commercially available yet, but we have used them, to remove PFAS from some environmental samples here in Kentucky.
Well, you mentioned samples, and I know that you had to sample water in various locations. Were there difficulties in getting those samples?
Yeah, we definitely encountered some pushback from various public water systems. And in order to sample at certain locations, we had to agree to not disclose that location. And you have to understand that, you know, out in these smaller counties, they are barely able to afford to operate. And funding for infrastructure repairs and upgrades in small communities is hard to come by sometimes. And so, you know, say we sample and then report to that community that there's high levels of PFAS. Well, then they're, you know, that public water system is going to have some angry community members demanding that they do something about it. So I guess, you know, they kind of want to live by the age-old motto, ignorance is bliss. But I do want to say that the Kentucky Department of Environmental Protection, KDEP, has done extensive sampling throughout the state. And that information is reported on Environmental Working Group website. That's EWG.org. And so you can go to that website and look up your specific public water system and see which contaminants were detected. So I really love that website. There's lots of information there about PFAS and different water filters. And something they reiterate, is that just because it's legal doesn't mean that it's safe.
Good point. Now, Molly, you've also received a K.C. Donnelly Externship Award, and it was for work with researchers at the EPA on figuring out the best way to apply environmental research to support legislative decision-making that's related to risk assessment. Where are you in that work, and what have you learned so far?
Yes, so this has been a great opportunity and offered through the UK Superfund Research Center, and it's there in order to promote transdisciplinary and translational research. So it's been very interesting to jump over from the lab to learn, this type of process. It's time consuming and it's long and you have to have patience. But there's a lot of research that's being conducted about PFAS and its effects in the environment and the human body. So all of that is being considered to build what is known as an evidence map. And then these evidence maps are used to inform legislation around these chemicals. But unfortunately, something we know, right, is that we haven't moved fast enough. And companies, ask forgiveness instead of permission. And we have to deal with the consequences of that policy or lack of policy. And then the EPA additionally does not regulate classes of chemicals, but instead individual chemicals, which can be a major issue because it means that the production of one type of PFAS could be banned, but then manufacturers can switch to a slightly different structure and still get similar results. And so now what you have is just like a dangerous mixture of all these various PFAS out there in the environment with little to no research on how those combinations affect our environment or our health. So it is rewarding and frustrating at the same time.
There is legislation working its way through the Kentucky General Assembly, House Bill 338. It's sponsored by Representative Nima Kulkarni, a Democrat from Jefferson County. And it calls for maximum PFAS chemical limits and requires monitoring of drinking water systems as well as discharges into rivers and streams. Now, are you familiar with that legislation following its progress?
Yes. So this was just first introduced in the House on January 20th. So this is going to be a great step for Kentucky. The Federal Safe Drinking Water Act requires that once every 5 years, the EPA issue a list of unregulated contaminants to be monitored by public water systems. And in fact, the fifth UCMR was just published last month, and it establishes nationwide monitoring for 29 different PFAS in drinking water. So although the EPA has set a federal advisory level of 70 parts per trillion for PFAS, this is not a regulation. It's just a signal for drinking water utilities to know which levels are considered elevated, right? So several states have adapted the EPA's recommendation of 70 parts per trillion PFAS concentration limit for drinking water. And our neighboring state, Ohio, has adapted that limit. But a lot of experts, including Environmental Working Group, argue that that number is too high. And so states have started setting their own limits. Minnesota, for example, has limited PFOA, PFOA to 15 parts per trillion. And so Kentucky doesn't currently have PFAS regulation, but this House Bill 338 can hopefully change that. I think it'll be a really great step in the right direction for Kentucky.
Well, I mentioned in the introduction that you're very interested, passionate about encouraging other young women like yourself to go into fields of science. Tell us where that passion comes from.
It all stems from being mentored throughout my childhood by my mother, who is also a scientist. And I realized that it's so important for young women to be able to see themselves in the scientist role. And I guess it also just comes from being a woman, and having strong, supportive female relationships. Women continue to be underrepresented in the science fields, and so we need to have active and engaged mentorship because I believe that's how we inspire confidence and motivation in our young women.
Are you currently mentoring any young women who are interested in science?
Oh, yes. Yes, I am. And, you know, it's really grown to be one of my greatest accomplishments and pleasures during my doctoral work at UK. So, you know, just for instance, like engineering undergraduates that want to gain lab experience might come in to see if they like it or if they're interested in graduate school. And then I get to teach them what I know and my skills and what I've learned. And I love that. And I'll also mention that, you know, UK has a couple of conferences that promote hands-on STEM for young girls and their parents. One specifically is called Expanding Your Horizons, and it aims to basically enable girls to recognize their potential and pursue opportunities in STEM fields.
What would you say are the biggest barriers to careers in science being encountered by women?
I think just not being aware of what opportunities are out there is a barrier. So outreach to underrepresented groups is extremely important, you know, as I've mentioned. And STEM departments at universities need to actively recruit these groups. Then I also think that, you know, wage disparities between genders is extremely frustrating and discouraging. So part of mentorship should really be educating young women about how to negotiate for what they deserve. But I want to say that, you know, collaboration will lead to the most impactful and significant scientific solutions because you gain a more diverse perspective. So, you know, these environmental issues that we discuss, PFAS specifically, they affect all of us. And we need appropriate representation to understand how everyone is impacted.
Well, Molly Fraser, I hope you're ready for the world to beat a path to your door, because it sounds to me as though they will. We thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
While Molly Fraser is working on a way to get those PFAS compounds out of our drinking water, Jason Marion is teaching a class here at EKU on water and health, and that keeps him current on drinking water issues in our region, on everything from safety to the availability of jobs in the field. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Marion.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Tom. This is such an important topic to so many folks.
It sure is. And so what makes your short list of drinking water issues in central and eastern Kentucky?
For me, the short list is continuing public education, both about career opportunities in this space, because we really need a well-trained group of professionals operating at our water treatment plants and our wastewater plants, as well as community organizations, partners, and friends aware of how the entire water system would benefit from their support, from not just drinking water treatment, but also protecting our groundwater resources and our surface waters. So having an educated citizenry and folks going into the profession, we have the silver tsunami is on its way, and it's already happening where we've had a lot of retirements across the state. And this is across the country in regards to people who are our operators as well. And there's good careers in this space. So that's probably at the top of the list. We can have great water infrastructure, but we need to make sure that we have the right folks in there, making sure that the investments we're making in public water infrastructure are sustainable.
In light of what's happened in places like Flint, Michigan, or Martin County in eastern Kentucky, is there a perception problem, a need to kind of restore public confidence in the water industry?
Absolutely. There have been legitimate reasons for why the public at a national level, or even international level, should have some concern, at least because of what they would have observed in the media. Nobody who was around in 2016 to 2018 couldn't observe what was happening with respect to the communities in Flint. And even here in Appalachia, the Patriot spill that happened in Charleston, West Virginia, that led to the black licorice tasting water over there, the reports in Martin County with sometimes very visual images of orange water coming out of the tap. I mean, those types of things make people think, wow, you know, what could be happening to my water? The reality, though, is every water system operates a little differently, and that they're not all connected to one another, and each water system has its own unique challenges. So it's best to kind of know our own water systems and our own water sources and take action locally when needed. And that starts with getting education, as well as making sure that we've got the right folks being held accountable when they don't follow the rules. And there's a good reason why people in the state may have different viewpoints on the safety of their water based upon what they may observe. And there are noticeable differences right here in Kentucky, as well as nationally, where people who are often of lower income, people who may be in a minority designated community, whether it be an Appalachian community or whether it be a traditionally Black community, are far more likely to use bottled water than public water, which is indicative of both a loss of public trust as well as legitimate concerns in terms of violations that show up in the Safe Drinking Water Act.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the bottled water. I mentioned that in the introduction, and I'd like to kind of expand on that for a minute. What have you been seeing in terms of the extent of its use in places like Eastern Kentucky?
Yeah, so when I first got involved with initially I would go to some of the Shaping Our Appalachian Region meetings, and I was introduced to a gentleman from the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky, and he advised me that they had done a Kentucky Health Issues poll. And I was thinking that, how much of the problem is people just don't perceive their water as safe, because perceptions are people's realities. And the Foundation for Healthy Kentucky had a water perceptions question in one of their earlier surveys. And upon doing an analysis of it, you can see pretty striking results. So statewide, about 55% of Kentuckians prefer to drink tap water. And there are various reasons why people would prefer to do that. Often financial, sometimes it's what's right for the environment in terms of reducing plastic consumption and energy. But Appalachian Kentuckians in particular, 54% of them prefer bottled water versus 38% with tap water. Mm. And the water elsewhere makes up the rest of it to get to 100%. So non-Appalachian Kentucky, if you live in the Bluegrass or even Western Kentucky, on average statewide, it's 60% are tap water versus 32% bottled water. So there's a very, very strong difference between tap water use and bottled water use. And that tap water includes like their own private groundwater if they're hooked up, as well as public water systems in that figure. So bottled water use is far, far more common in Appalachian Kentucky. And then when you break the data down, I can look at the percents and stuff as it relates to who's more or less likely to use it. If you've got a college education, you are 39% more likely to use tap water. If you are from an Appalachian county, you're about 2.5 times more likely than other Kentuckians to use bottled water. If you're non-white, if you're, Black or Hispanic, you got a 90% increased likelihood of using bottled water rather than tap water. So there's some real concerns about trusting what's coming out of the tap, and it's more pronounced in Appalachian Kentucky and low-income communities and also minority communities. And there's some good reason for it, based upon their perceptions, at least.
Wow, that's really interesting. Here's a fun thing to talk about on the radio, Jason, fecal contamination. but when we hear about fecal contamination, we think of like failed rural septic systems, farm runoff, that kind of thing. But it's not exclusively rural, is it?
In terms of fecal contamination, suburban communities, urban communities, rural communities, we can have it anywhere, at any time, and for various reasons that exist in all of those. So happy to discuss more. But on a drinking water side, our water systems in Kentucky, though, are really good at what they do. They're very good at removing a lot of contaminants. Most of the issues with respect to water quality in the state tend to be more associated with the distribution or how we report information out. Most of the violations exist with reporting, not testing enough, bottled water companies don't to do that. So I just want to make that clear. And then with respect to fecal contamination of all water, the problems do exist, and there's good reason to clean these things up. But the good thing is from a drinking water treatment perspective, fecal contamination of our drinking water systems that are publicly treated are not much of a problem. People going out and scavenging water from springs or scavenging water from somewhere else, they're much more likely to be exposed to fecally contaminated water. Or if they're on their own private groundwater system, they also may be more likely to be exposed to fecally contaminated water, which does increase their risk for diarrheal illness and a lot more.
Some cities, I believe it began with Boston, have taken to sampling their sewage water to determine the trajectory of COVID. Are you familiar with that?
I'm very, very familiar with this topic. I've worked alongside some folks that are experts in this area, so happy to expand more. We even explored the possibility of implementing some of that right here at EKU earlier in the pandemic.
Well, it seems to make so much sense.
From a surveillance perspective, absolutely, especially if you're on the front end of a pandemic or the front end of an epidemic showing up in your community, or if you're trying to determine the presence or absence of a variant in the community. So you can look for Omicron variant because they're that good. A colleague of mine at Baylor University, Dr. Brian Brooks, they were able to detect Delta signals in the wastewater before Delta showed up in the actual Texas healthcare system. So you can definitely do a good job with it for determining the presence or absence, and it will have great utility in the future. You could look at wastewater coming out of airports. You could archive the wastewater. The real challenge with using it, though, in terms of during an epidemic or a pandemic, is we haven't quite fine-tuned how to determine the density of it in the water, at what point of it is associated with more problems. You have to have more sampling locations, and it does get a little bit expensive in trying to develop all the different sampling locations. But in terms of presence or absence, is it here or not? Are those variants here or not? We're already on top of that, I think, as a public health science discipline right now for the country. But fine-tuning it to be able to use it and figure out how to determine if a pandemic is spiking at an epidemic level in our communities. We've still got some ways to go, but I think we can get there.
Well, it's so interesting that science is really scrambling to keep up with this pandemic, and that seems to be a great example of some science that's happening out there that's going to have a practical application in a very big way very soon. You've also raised concerns about boil water advisories from health departments and the media's role in reporting them. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. So in terms of boil water advisories and public notification, there are a lot of requirements that go into effect with respect to when you have a water line break. And our communities are doing the responsible thing and following the law. The Safe Drinking Water Act requires them to notify communities and do their best to make sure folks know. And when the water potentially is needing a boil water advisory, we have to let folks know. So the public health impact of that is, you know, well, maybe more people will drink more bottled water because they tend to be concerned about their water, especially if you're in communities around the state where they have more line breaks. And when you're having a lot of water line breaks and the news hears about, you know, boil water advisories, and you never hear about problems that might happen in the bottled water industry, it does tend to push people down the route that my water is not safe, because the only time you hear about your water system through the news, well, thankfully today we're talking a little bit about it, is when it's bad, rather than when it's, you know, usually everything is okay. We're kind of like the offensive lineman on a football field. You know, if you're in public health or environmental health or in the water world, when everything's going good, the economy's humming, the quarterback and the wide receivers are getting all the attention. But when something breaks, you know, our defense mechanisms, our water treatment system breaks down and the flag is thrown on the offensive lineman, that's when you hear about them. So unfortunately for our public water infrastructure, The only time the media really covers a lot of things is because, you know, it's really not news, but they're obligated to report boil water advisories. And in some parts of the state, when these line breaks happen, and it's happening across a large area, especially in like the wintertime when, you know, sometimes there's a lot of freezing of pipes and different reasons that lead to that, you end up with a long list of boil water advisories, and that can sometimes present public perception challenges that would make people think, oh, my water's not safe. There's a whole bunch of boil water advisory. It may not even be your community. It could be the county over, but it might still influence your perception.
All right. From the Department of Environmental Health Science here at EKU, that's Dr. Jason Marion. Thanks, Jason.
Yes, sir.
Coming up after the break.
I think the strategy to ban books from any institution, school, whether it be school system, library, or in any way, is a misguided one.
And
I'm really a true conductor. That is, that I'm a medium for emotions to flow, for the intentions of the composer is from the score to the musician to the audience. And I'm that medium to connect everything together.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members and helping local residents through Co-op Connections, a benefit partnership between local health services and the cooperative that connects members with dental, vision, and other benefits. More at connections.coop.
And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
McMinn County, Tennessee has been all over media lately for a decision by the county school board to ban from the district's eighth grade curriculum about the Holocaust the Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel Mouse, A Survivor's Tale. By American cartoonist Art Spiegelman and first published in 1986, Mouse depicts Jewish people as mice and Nazis as cats. It describes the experiences of Spiegelman's parents in Nazi concentration camps and his mother's suicide. School board members objected to what one described as rough, objectionable language and images they deemed unsuitable for 13- and 14-year-olds. Whitney Kimball Coe is a young mom in Athens, Tennessee, an hour's drive northeast from Chattanooga, about the same distance, heading south from Knoxville, and she is vice president of national programs for the Center for Rural Strategies, the publisher of the Daily Yonder, which has published an op-ed by her on this matter. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Whitney.
Thanks for having me.
And I know from reading your op-ed that this is an extremely difficult and delicate thing for you, expressing your outrage over the banning of this novel while also preserving relationships with your neighbors and local leaders. So let's begin with the source of that outrage. Why do you object to pulling Mouse from the curriculum?
Well, I think the strategy to ban books from any institution, school, whether it be school system, library, or in any way, is a misguided one. I was trying to explain it to my 8-year-old and 11-year-old who've been interested in this topic since it's happened in McMinn. You know, why does it matter? And the simplest answer I could come up with was that you can't stop ideas, you can't stop imagination, you can't keep people from learning and being curious and asking questions. That stymieing people's instinct for curiosity and learning will actually backfire. So, you know, that just on principle, I disagree with book bans, but the more tender issue here is sort of how this came about here locally and what the backlash has been around it.
Well, one member of the county school board has been quoted as saying about Mouse, it shows people hanging, it shows them killing kids. Why does the education system promote this kind of stuff. It's not wise or healthy. That word promote, I stop on that. What is your thinking about it?
Well, and as you described in your introduction about what the story of mouse is, what it is about, it would be very hard to sanitize the history of the Holocaust. It's very hard to sanitize the story of Art Spiegelman's family and what they went through. And the idea that we are promoting anything other than the truth is just folly. So, you know, I think there clearly is just some misunderstanding about what is the school board truly after here? Are they really worried about purity, or are they worried about making sure that our kids are accompanied as they discover and learn about the horrors of the Holocaust, which were profane and were brutal in many ways?
They are brutal images, and it was a brutal experience for millions and millions of people. And I'm just wondering, as a parent, what is your position on your own kids when they reach the eighth grade being exposed to those images and to the horrors of the Holocaust?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll say that I started learning about the Holocaust in third grade, and I was just fascinated when I was in third grade by it. That's when I read Number of the Stars by Lois Lowry. I also happened to have a teacher who was German in third grade, and who took it upon herself to start giving us information about the Holocaust. So by the time I was in eighth grade, it was very clear to me. I'd already read The Diary of Anne Frank by then, what that story was about and what it portended for our history and our present. So my stance is that we have to start teaching our kids early enough so that they start to develop the empathy, the compassion, and the awareness that will carry them through their lives.
The American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom says they have never before had so many people challenging books. Is this ban on mouse really part of something bigger, a nationwide struggle over what a child, a reader, or a society ought to be allowed to think, to know, to question?
I mean, it certainly seems that way. When I was researching that for my article or my op-ed about this, I came across a statistic from the Association for American Libraries that said, you know, book bans have increased over 61% in just a year from September 2020 to 2021. So I think there is certainly a national movement that is organized by certain national groups with an eye toward controlling local politics. And when you're thinking about how do you control local politics, inserting cultural wedges that push people into their tribal corners around different values, perhaps, can be a winning strategy to create wedges in small towns. So yes, I think this is certainly a national issue. This is not just a McMinn County issue. It's certainly not just a rural issue. I was on a call the other day with someone who was suggesting that we needed to do more to promote acceptance in rural places. But I would say that this is not relegated to just rural zip codes.
Although we've had fits and starts, by and large, this democratic society of ours is about being free to understand, to weigh difficult, challenging, even hateful or problematic ideas. And isn't that how we go about developing understanding of, and as you said, empathy toward other people?
I mean, that's been my experience. If somebody tells you their story or tells you about their experience, it makes it harder for you to objectify them. That is, if you've listened to what they're offering you. Maybe you disagree with it. Maybe to the core of your being, you disagree with what they're offering. But actually listening to someone offer up their own thoughts, experiences, I feel like can only help break down barriers. Now, when we refuse to listen and we refuse to entertain any ideas that are different from our own, or to look outside our community into others and imagine how all these things are playing out, then that just creates more walls, more barriers, more divisiveness. It becomes easier to dehumanize, you know, say, McMinn County school board members. If you vehemently disagree with what happened in McMinn, and you don't necessarily live in McMinn, then these individuals are perhaps not real for you. but I know many of them, and you know, they have families. I live, worship, and work with them on different projects. So I feel like, in a way, I have a different degree of empathy, and all of those things are just are bound up in our ability to be able to share, spread, and talk about ideas, whether they be hard or easy.
Well, I mentioned in the introduction that this has been all over media, and it sure has. When you type M-A-U-S into Google, all kinds of media comes up with this story. What's your feeling about the way this controversy has been portrayed by major global media?
There's so many layers to this, and it's hard to know where to begin. One of the things I wanted to point out was that for many of us in McMinn County, we didn't know about this board decision until 3 weeks after it was made. And that's partly because the board met, you know, in a call meeting very last minute, and the very small local media that we have was unable to cover it, perhaps, and so they didn't. And so for 3 weeks, this was dormant for many of us, and we didn't see it until national and global headlines announced it, and Neil Gaiman retweeted about it, and, you know, Art Spiegelman came on CNN to talk about it. So that was bewildering in a lot of ways, and it also points to, you know, an issue that is rife across the United States, and that is the dissolving of local media and their ability to cover what's going on in our midst and help us create narratives and drive our own narratives and think about, you know, what is really affecting us in our communities. So to have it come at you from a national headline or from Neil Gaiman was a little bit bewildering. But I will also say that I think it is important that a national spotlight, a global spotlight, is shown on these things, that in order for us to change perceptions and change our culture globally around making sure that book bans are not a strategy that are employed to control a population, then I think we absolutely need that national and global scrutiny. What I don't appreciate and what I don't think we need, and certainly what local folks in McMinn don't need, is to be painted with a broad brush by national media. That is, to be treated as a monolith of opinion about what happened, because there are many, many of us, and I've, you know, even within 24 hours of finding out that this happened, many of us are strategizing, coming together, talking about how can we push back, how can we change our own culture locally. So when those national outlets or global outlets portray us as a part of the problem, we feel much more alienated, certainly more alone in addressing it. It also has the byproduct, or perhaps the unintended consequence, of in a way forcing our officials to dig their heels in a little deeper. They can say, you don't live here, you don't know our kids, you don't know our school system. And it makes it harder for them to either acknowledge that they've made a mistake or, you know, stand up and reverse the decision. And I'm not letting them off the hook, but I will say that it makes it harder then for us locals who want to help them make that decision to do that work.
Well, I guess it should come as no surprise, because this seems to always happen, but since this controversy grabbed global attention, Mouse has shot up to the top 10 lists in all kinds of Amazon book categories. It's pretty ironic, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I mean, that's probably the, you know, the best unintended consequence of book bans, right? Art Spiegelman must be so pleased, his publisher must be so pleased, and then, of course, the world must be, I'm so grateful that, you know, I read Mouse when I was in high school, and then I read it again in college, and I had, you know, my peers to talk about it with, but not a whole community. Well, now I have a whole community to talk about it with, and all of us are going to be wrestling with those really difficult themes that you and I have talked about at the beginning of this interview. And, you know, there's going to be opportunity for all of us to experience the power of storytelling through Mouse. And if there were a positive to all of this, maybe that would be it.
All right. Whitney Kimball Coe, Vice President of National Programs at the Center for Rural Strategies. Thank you so much, Whitney.
Thank you so much.
We reached out to McMinn County Board of Education Chair Sharon Brown for comment and didn't receive a response. If you agree with the board's actions and believe certain books should be banned from public schools and libraries, email your thoughts to es@eku.edu. The Lexington Philharmonic, Lexphil as we call it, was midway into its search for a new music director and conductor when on March 20th of 2020, the pandemic brought those efforts to a full stop. Well, the search is resuming this month. The next candidate to come to Lexington for an intense week of meet and greets and performance is Julia Tai, music director of the Missoula Symphony Orchestra and Chorale, Philharmonia Northwest, and the co-artistic director of the Seattle Modern Orchestra. Her career has included performances and rehearsals in the Czech Republic, Germany, Estonia, Bulgaria, and Mexico. Julia Tai, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And so, first of all, I'm always curious about this. What was it about music that it became your life's work? Was it family, a performance that you experienced, or a teacher that you had?
I think it's all of the above. I'm lucky to have a very supportive and music family. My mother is a high school music teacher, so she conducts the choir, and she's also a music director at the church. So I've always grown up with a lot of music in the house, and I play the violin since I was 4 and a half. The reason is that she wants to be able to take me to church choir rehearsals, and I accompany the choir, so she doesn't need the babysitter. So I've always been in music, and I think making it a career out of it is a different story, and I'm fortunate enough to have wonderful conducting teachers who took me in and believed in me, and so I can become who I am today as a musician.
How did you find yourself being steered onto that path from being a musician to conductor?
It's kind of serendipity. In my case, I wasn't one of those five-year-olds always holding up a chopstick and wanting to be a conductor. I started as a violinist, as I just said, and I studied piano and harmony when I was in music schools. And I actually went into singing for a while. I was singing in the operas when I was at University of Southern California. And that I found also being very helpful in understanding the human voice and learning how to act. And then I kind of met my teacher while singing an opera at USC by the name of George Mester, who was actually a conductor of Louisville Orchestra for a long time. So he took me in and then gave me an audition and then gave me lessons. So I started conducting, and I felt that once I started studying conducting, I could put all of the different knowledge I have in instrumental and vocal world and put it together and working with people and kind of create those concerts together. And I really enjoy that process of working with people. And sometimes you feel like you're a product manager, you know, make sure everybody's doing their pieces, and then you put it together and then have a wonderful experience for the audience.
Well, Julia, I watched a video on your site, juliatai.com. You were conducting a performance of Beethoven Symphony No. 9, First Movement, and I turned off the sound and I just watched. Your motion and your expression, and they seem to embody and portray the music. Does that happen naturally, or do conductors cultivate their own performance style, if you will?
Yeah, well, you definitely learn to hone your skills, so whatever you're thinking in your head comes out in your body language. So that is something that we worked on a lot in conducting lessons, in addition to analysis and understanding the piece, of course. But yes, to kind of represent the music is always what I feel I'm doing as a conductor. You know, I'm really a true conductor, that is that I'm a medium for emotions to flow, for the intentions of the composer, from the score to the musician to the audience, and I'm that medium to connect everything together.
So interesting. So you're physically channeling the music. And you know, that came through, actually. It really did, even without the sound.
Thank you.
Do you have a favorite experience while conducting that you could tell us about?
It's really hard to choose. I always said it's like picking your favorite kid. Every concert I do, I love doing it, and I love all kinds of different repertoire. But one particular very memorable occasion was I did a concert in collaboration with the Finlandia Foundation to celebrate the centennial of Finland's independence. And we had put together this concert with a Finnish choir with four different generations of Finnish composers. And then there are lots of Finnish people in the audience. And actually the ambassador from Finland in Washington, D.C. flew out to Seattle to see this concert we put together in Benaroya Hall. So we did, of course, sang the Finlandia by Sibelius, and we also did one of his cantatas. And they were talking about homeland, and it was just such an emotional occasion. And when I turned around to take my bow, I could just see tears in people's eyes in the audience. Mm. And it was such a special occasion to be together, even though I'm not Finnish, but being able to celebrate that culture and their homeland with them. It's a very special experience.
It sounds wonderful. Well, what is most exciting to you about River Rouge Transfiguration, the program that you'll be conducting at the Singletary Center here in Lexington on February 25th?
Yeah, I love Missy Mazzoli's music. She's so inventive, and she really combines the great rhythm with lush harmony. So it's not, her music is never cold. And this particular piece, River Rouge Transfiguration, was so interesting because it was commissioned by the Detroit Symphony, and it was inspired by the Ford Motor Plant. And she talked about the photographs and the paintings of Charles Schiller, the modernist, American modernist, that combining the really straight line, kind of an industrial, kind of boring plant with emotions and all these colors and feelings, and how she sees the plant, the conveyor belts and everything, as a big church pipe organ, and that's, humming the big chords and beautiful melodies, and to combine that, something we wouldn't thought of, the industrial, kind of mundane daily life with something spiritual, and then put it together in the piece, and it's really beautiful. So you will hear the kind of the underlying motor with the rhythm with this lush harmony on top, and all the lines intertwined, kind of like people's life coming together, and it's just a beautiful piece.
What makes the Julia Tai playlist when you're not conducting orchestras, when you're being just chilling out, being Julia? What what do you like to listen to?
I love listening to jazz, from Bill Evans to Ella Fitzgerald. I'm fascinated with that era of music. Mm-hmm. It's just so beautiful, and it gets me out of my classical music mind, which is great.
What do you think the future holds for classical music and for classical music audiences, for that matter?
Well, I think the future is great. There is so much creativity going on right now in the classical music world. There's always been great creativity since the beginning of orchestras 300-400 years ago. And so, but what is adding to it right now is, different cultural influences. So it's not just European, but also Asian or African-American or Latin American, all of those different cultural influences that come into the classical music to make it diverse and great and new ideas. And I always find that classical music is a window for you to understand a particular culture. And for me, as a young kid growing up in Taiwan, it was a window into 19th century Vienna that I have not experienced. And so, that I think people in the future would be able to find pieces that exist in our era and kind of get a sense of what it's like to live in early 21st century America. So I think the longevity is there. I always see classical music as a constantly evolving cultural event. It's not a museum like, it's only things in the past, but it's constantly changing. And that will always go on, and it's a window for us to understand the world better, understand different people. So I'm very optimistic about what it holds in the future.
Well, how about the role of the orchestra and community engagement? What's your philosophy on those things?
Mm-hmm. I think an orchestra is a place where people can come together to celebrate, to heal, to experience human emotions, or just be with each other. I think we've never been to a wedding or a funeral without music. You know, it's such an important part for people to mark their milestones. And it's the same thing in the community, that orchestra is there to celebrate and mark milestones with the community, and sometimes to heal, to mourn together. And it's such an important part. So I think for a long time, the orchestras are kind of exist in the concert hall, that you wait for people to come and hear a concert. But it's changing now. In fact, music can be anywhere. It could be in all kinds of venues, and people are surrounded by orchestral music all the time, in the movies or video games. You know, it's always there. And so I think going out to meet people on the street, so to speak, and to really bring them in and make them realize the value music can bring into their lives, and to understand all of those great pieces that we have, and really to provide that enjoyment.
All right, that's Julia Tai, music director of the Missoula Symphony Orchestra and Chorale, Philharmonia Northwest, co-artistic director of the Seattle Modern Orchestra, and candidate for music director and conductor of the Lexington Philharmonic, Lexphil. Thank you and good luck, Julia.
Thank you.
Next week, we're going to begin a year-long series about something state law requires of Kentucky communities, a comprehensive plan. It's time for Lexington to hit the refresh button, and joining us with details of the various issues from housing to environment that are on the table for discussion is CivicLex Director Richard Young.
Really what it does is set sort of long-term vision and sort of guiding principles for land use policy in a even community. So in Lexington, obviously, that focuses on all of Fayette County.
And
people don't always think of traditional music as a world music, as a global music, but it is. And it's arguably more influential now than it ever has been.
Forecastle Festival founder J.K. McKnight on why he sees strong promise in Eastern Kentucky for the writing of the Commonwealth's next musical chapter. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Wendy Barnett, producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.